6 this morning. John chapter 6, we'll do the first 14 verses. Jesus has been down in the southern area of Israel, in the city of Jerusalem. We've been following all that in John chapter 5, as he healed a man who had been paralyzed for 38 years. We now skip ahead a little bit, a few months ahead, and Jesus is going to be back up north in the area of Galilee. And I think we'll read through the whole passage first. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what are they among so many?" Then Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost." Therefore they gathered them up, filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves that were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." So let's go back to verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Now, if you haven't picked up on it yet, the Sea of Galilee is called by a lot of different names in the Scripture. It just kind of depends on what your perspective is. It's just a big lake. It's not salt water or anything, so I don't know why we would call it a sea, but they did because it looked like a big sea to them. But it's a big lake. It's usually called Galilee. Here it's called another name. We also hear it being called the Sea of Tiberias. That's because of a city that was built, about 10 years earlier than Jesus, along the side of the lake. It was built by Herod Antipas. There's a little zoom in of the current modern city of Tiberias. And he built it and named it after his boss, the Caesar in Rome, Caesar Tiberius. Kiss up to the boss kind of a thing. "Hey, look, we built you a city. We named it after you. How about that?" It was built around 22 AD. This lake, Sea of Galilee, Sea of Tiberias, it's also called at times the Sea of Kinneret or the Lake Kinneret. Kinneret is a Hebrew word. I think it's the Hebrew word for heart. And that's because if you look at it on a map, it's the shape of a human heart. So that's another name for it. It's got lots of different names. It's the same. It's one place, though. It says, "Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased." We've seen this word for signs before. It's special miracles. John has written about how he's recorded some of the many signs because he wants you to believe. He wants you to get it, that Jesus is different. Jesus is the Son of God. That's his whole goal in telling you all about these things. And it says these people followed him because they saw these signs. At the moment, they're more interested in the miracles than they are the miracle worker. Hopefully that will change, but I wouldn't hold my breath right now. It says they saw the signs, including what he performed on those who were diseased. And the only reason I bring this up is that this is the same word that was used to describe that fellow back in John 5, the fellow that was paralyzed for 38 years. It said there that he had an infirmity or a weakness for 38 years. And I'm only bringing that up because we've looked at this fellow and how Jesus healed him. And that's just a picture of the many people that Jesus had healed. And so crowds are starting to form and trying to follow this guy because, my gosh, look what he can do. This guy's pretty cool. Verse 3, and Jesus went up to the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now, when it talks about a mountain in the New Testament, you got to be careful that you aren't thinking Big Bear and snowboarding and stuff like that. That's what we think of as mountains. In Israel, there's only one mountain that would qualify for that. That would be Mount Hermon is the way they pronounce it. But you look on a map and it's Mount Hermon. That's up in the very far north of Israel. When most of the times when you see the word mountain in the New Testament, just think of hills, okay? The hill that was known as the Mount of Beatitudes, this is taken from this huge high hill. It's like the size of Acacia Hill. So it's not really a mountain. Just think of a nice sloping hill. Okay, you with me? The Gospels give us a little more backstory to this. Matthew tells us that in Matthew 14, he says that this all took place right after John the Baptist was beheaded by Herod. When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. And when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. When I read Matthew's account, I realize that Jesus wasn't just like happy-go-lucky guy at this point. Somebody very close to him, his cousin, the fellow that was the prophesied man who would come and kind of warm up the crowd for Jesus, the one who baptized Jesus, the one at Jesus' baptism, the Spirit came on Jesus, and the Father spoke and said, "This is my beloved Son." That John. He's been killed. And this is what Jesus has just heard about. And Matthew's account gives me the feeling that Jesus wants to kind of get away from it a little bit. That's the kind of the sense that I get. Mark records another aspect of the event. Mark tells us... Sorry, Manny. Manny, raise your hands. I want everybody to know that I'm making fun of you up here, buddy. Mark tells us that another event that has just happened is that Jesus has sent the disciples out on little mini mission trips. And they've been all over the northern Galilee area preaching the gospel. And they've just come back and they're kind of wiped. Mark says, then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. Probably they're the ones that have the message about John as well. And it says, and he said to them, come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. So another little flavor of what's happening at the time is that the disciples are, I mean, they're wasted. They've been pushing the limits. They haven't had any sleep, haven't even had a chance to go through In and Out. I mean, they want a break. And Jesus sees that and he says, look, guys, let's get away for a little while. So again, a little more story behind it. Luke gives us one more clue. It says he took them and went aside privately into a deserted place belonging to the city of Bethsaida. So Luke actually gives us the location or better idea about it. Bethsaida is on the north edge of the lake. It was Peter's hometown. Now, I don't know if you can see this very well. This is the edge of the lake from the satellite view. And the ruins of Bethsaida is a mile and a half inland. In Jesus' day, the lake was bigger. The shoreline went right up to Bethsaida. There have been numerous earthquakes that have changed the coastline just a little bit. And so nowadays, the ruins of Bethsaida are a mile and a half away, but they weren't in Jesus' day. In fact, in Jesus' day, it was a fishing town. And here's a mosaic from a floor in Bethsaida dating back to Jesus' day, where they've got fishing boats on this thing. If we do our little Google Earth zoom-in thing, there's the Sea of Galilee, Tiberias. There's Capernaum, Jesus' home base, Bethsaida up to the top. And as we zoom into Bethsaida and we kind of spin around a little bit, you'll see that around Bethsaida, you're going to see, I hope you don't get dizzy here. Everybody hold on to your seats. You see that Bethsaida is surrounded by hills. And so it's somewhere in these hills is where Jesus and his fellows are trying to get away from it all. You with me so far? You kind of get the idea, get the picture? Now it says back in our text, in John 3, that he sat with his disciples. Now, it's not sitting down to rest. The reason John mentions this is because this is, he's describing that Jesus is getting, he's about to teach. This is what teachers do. A fellow named Maimonides, he was a famous Jewish philosopher in the Middle Ages. He said, the master sits at the head or in the chief place, and the disciples before him in a circuit like a crown so that they all see the master and hear his words. So that kind of sets the stage about what's happening. Jesus is sitting down to spend some time with his disciples. And see, that's the way it used to be in the old days. The teacher sits and the students stand. You think we ought to try that? What do you think, huh? I'm kind of tired of being up on my... No. Actually, it changed. It changed about 50 years, 40, 50 years. I don't know, maybe not that long. About 20 or 30 years after Jesus, the famous Jewish teacher Gamaliel, the rabbi Gamaliel, who was Paul's teacher, when he died, the Jews all said, well, the glory of the law has departed, and so they changed the rules. And after Gamaliel died, then the students started sitting, and the teachers were forced to stand. So, darnness. But in Jesus' day, he's sitting, and that's because we're setting up a teaching time. Verse 4 says, now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Passover. This is that holiday that the Jews celebrate every year to remember Charlton Heston, Moses, you know, parting the Red Sea and delivering them from Egypt and all that kind of stuff, right? It was also when they painted the blood of a lamb on the doorposts of their house, and the angel of death came through Egypt that night. Remember, and all the firstborn of every household was killed, except those that have the blood of the lamb on it, because the angel of the death would pass over them. Hence the name Passover. We have the time of year. It's the Passover. This is around springtime. The Passover is connected with another feast called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Passover would begin on the 14th of the Jewish month. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread would start the next day for 7 days. And for 7 days, the Jews would not eat any. They'd put all the Wonder Bread away. You put anything that's risen with yeast, no sourdough bread. Everything is non-yeasted, unleavened. So it's like pita bread. It's like like crackers. This was to remind them that when they fled Egypt, they didn't have a chance to let their dough raise. Instead, they all ate unleavened bread. So it's all about remembering what's gone on. The reason I bring all this up is it's not a coincidence that Jesus is going to be multiplying loaves of bread. And Jesus is going to be making a statement saying that he is the bread of life. Because it's a perfect setting. It's the perfect time. There's got to keep all these links in place. Verse 5. It says, then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, where should we buy bread that these may eat? I just want to stop and think about this for a second. Jesus
is aware of the situation. Even though he's just lost somebody very close to him, somebody very important to him, he could be saying, get these people away from me. I just want to be alone.
The disciples, now they're kind of wiped out from their trips, from their mission trips. You know what it's like after a mission trip? I mean, you just want to go home and sleep for like 5 days. You know, that's all you want to do. They seem to be oblivious to this. Jesus says to them, what are we going to do with these people? How are we going to feed them? Sometimes, beloved, we get so consumed with the stuff going on in our lives that we ignore the big stuff right around us. I'll see it in church when, you know, I don't know why people come up to talk to me after church. I mean, there's a lot better people to talk to than to me. But sometimes people want to come up and talk to the pastor. I guess that's just part of my job. Yeah, I guess. But it amazes me how someone will be standing here talking to me and some kid will fall over on the floor running around, you know, because kids, we let kids run wild in here, you know. And some kid trips and falls and has got, you know, scraped up their knee, and they're still talking to me because they have to talk to the pastor. It's like, hold on a second, let's take care of this kid. I love the way that Jesus responds to these things. He's aware of it. He's not so focused on himself that he doesn't see the needs around him. That's my Jesus. That's my Jesus. I love this. I love this about him. So he says to Philip, where should we buy bread that these meat? Remember, they're out in the hills. There isn't an In-N-Out within miles. Or a Panera Bread. There's none of that stuff. Not even a Starbucks. Of course, they don't have Starbucks in Israel. They have, what's it? They have Aroma is their coffee chain. It says, verse 6, but this he said to test him. He's testing Philip. The word that's used for test, perazo, the Greek word, means to try, to make a trial of, to test for the purpose of ascertaining his quality or what he thinks or how he will behave himself. Sometimes this word is used in the sense of being tempted to do the wrong thing, like being tempted to sin or something like that. But that's not the case here. Here, Jesus isn't trying to tempt Philip to do a bad thing. He's testing him. He's testing him. You know, the story is that there was this old couple who had their son still lived with them. These folks are kind of getting on in age. You know, their son's still living with them. Parents were a little worried. The son seemed a little unable to decide about his future career, so they decided to do a small test. They put a note on the front hall table that they had left. And around the note, they left a $10 bill, a Bible, and a bottle of whiskey. Then they hid. They were pretending like they weren't home. The father told his wife, if our son takes the money, well, that shows us he's going to be a businessman. If our son takes the Bible, well, that tells us he's going to become a pastor. If he takes the bottle of whiskey, well, that just tells us he's going to grow up to be a drunkard. So the parents hid in the nearby closet, and they waited a little bit nervously. They peeped through the keyhole, and they saw their son arrive. The son reads the note that they're gone, and then he takes the $10 bill. He looks at it up against the light, puts it in his pocket. After that, he takes the Bible and he kind of flips through it and sticks it under his arm. Finally, he grabs the bottle of whiskey. He opens it, takes a whiff, and kind of smiles and carries it off. And he leaves. The father slaps his forehead and he says, this is worse than I ever could have imagined. Well, what? Said the wife. Well, this means he's going to be a politician. I like that. That was pretty good. Jesus is testing Philip. He's not tempting him to do evil. He's testing him to see if he's going to do the right thing. You could say it's a pop quiz. Does that strike terror in your hearts? Do the words pop quiz strike terror? How many of you have to admit the word pop quiz? Okay, gang, we're going to have a pop quiz. Is it still that close to being in school that it makes you shake? Let's talk about difficulties in quizzes. Sometimes, gang, the difficulties that we go through, sometimes they are, in fact, tests from God. It's a pop quiz. The disciples are now faced with the impossible task of feeding thousands of people without adequate resources, all while being drop-dead tired. I imagine that some of the aid workers in Haiti are feeling a little bit like that right now. Don't you think? Couldn't you imagine that? I imagine that for some of you in this room, the current state of the economy kind of has you feeling a little bit the same way. This is a test. It's a test. There are reasons, by the way, that teachers give pop quizzes. Number one, it reveals how you're doing, doesn't it? I mean, it shows whether you've been paying attention to class or whether you, I can't say passing notes to Mary. You have to say you're texting Mary, right? Because that's probably what we do nowadays, except Mary doesn't do text messages. Or do you do text messages? You're not in, I'm not going to tell. Because you're busy writing a text message right now. Here we go. It shows how you're doing. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, examine yourselves to see if your faith is genuine. Test yourselves. Surely you know that Jesus Christ is among you. If not, you have failed the test of genuine faith. It's a test. During a visit to a mental asylum, the visitor asked the director what the criteria was that defines whether a patient should be institutionalized. Well, said the director, we take a bathtub and we fill it up. And then next to the bathtub, we place three things. We place a bucket, a teacup, and a teaspoon. And so this is the test that we give our patients. We say, ask them to empty the tub. And would you use the spoon? Would you use the teacup? Or would you use the bucket? Okay, think about this. Think about which would you do? Oh, said the visitor, I understand. A normal person would choose the bucket since it's larger than the teacup or the spoon. No, said the director. The normal person pulls the plug. Now, how many of you think you ought to be committed now? How many of us failed that one? So how are you doing? The test reveals how you're doing. Tests are also an incentive to study. Knowing that your teacher on any day could throw a pop quiz at you, doesn't that kind of usually make you study a little bit harder? That's kind of the purposes for it. Paul said, in 2 Timothy, he says, work hard so you can present yourselves to God and receive his approval. Be a good worker, one who does not need to be ashamed and who correctly explains the word of truth. It's an incentive to study. Let's talk about passing the test. Abraham faced a test. In Genesis 22, it says, now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Now, we know that Abraham passed his test. He took his beloved son Isaac up to Mount Moriah, and he got everything ready. He raised his knife, ready to sacrifice his son. And God stopped him. And God said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, your only begotten son. If God was tempting Abraham to sin, trying to entice him to kill Isaac, he would have let him do that. He wasn't tempting him to sin. He was testing him. And so he stopped him because he passed the test. He passed the test. A mother writes this. She says, I was out walking with my 4-year-old daughter. She picked up something off the ground and started to put it in her mouth. I took the item away from her and I asked her not to do that. Why, my daughter said, because it's been laying outside. You don't know where it's been. It's dirty and probably has germs, I replied. At this point, my daughter looked at me with total admiration and said, wow, how do you know all this stuff? I was thinking quickly, all moms know this stuff. It's on the mommy test. It's on the mommy test. Where's the mommy test? There's the mommy test. You have to know it, or they don't let you be a mommy. We walked along in silence for 2 or 3 minutes, but she's thinking, the wheels are turning, the gears are turning, and she said, I get it. So if you don't pass the test, you have to be a daddy. I'm a dad. God wants you to pass the test. Now, Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 10:13. Now, we usually think of this verse in terms of temptation towards sin, but the Greek word pirazo is in this verse. And I think it's possible that I can see this verse applying even in difficult tests. Paul says this, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted, and that's the word parazo there, will not allow you to be tempted or tested beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. God promises to make a way out, a way through it. For the disciples, it looks kind of like, how are we going to get out of this one? You want us to feed, you want us to do what? You know, feed all these people? We don't have any money on us. We don't have any food with us. Well, how are we going to do this? All we've got, you know, they're gonna finally scare up a kid that's got a little lunch. You know, we've got that, but then again, they do have Jesus with them, don't they? They do have Jesus with them. I think a key to passing God's tests is that we learn to trust Him. And I learned to trust Him. That's how Abraham passed it. That's how Abraham passed his test. Hebrews says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. It was through faith that he could do it because he trusted God. He trusted God. The situation is difficult. I don't know the way out. But I'm going to trust you. Are you in a test right now? Are you in a test right now? Are you going through a difficult thing? I imagine there might be one or two of us in here who don't know the way out. God wants to encourage you that you can trust Him. So how's Philip going to do? And it said this he said to test him because he himself knew what he was going to do. He knew what he was going to do. Jesus knew what he was going to do. That's kind of part of the key to how you trust him. Do I think he knows what he's going to do? The answer to that question is, help you cheat on the test. The answer to the question, does God know what he's doing? The answer is, yes. Yes, God knows what he's doing. Yes, he knows what he's doing. I don't have a clue what he's doing. Don't ask me what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. As the Union Pacific Railroad was being constructed, an elaborate trestle bridge was built across a large canyon in the west. They wanted to test the bridge, so the builder loaded a train with enough extra cars and equipment to double the normal payload. The train was then driven into the middle of the bridge, and it stayed there an entire day. One worker said, "Are you trying to see if you can break the bridge?" The builder said, "Uh-uh. I'm trying to prove that the bridge won't break." That's how God's tests work, beloved. He's not trying to break you. He knows what he's going to do. He's trying to show you that you won't break. And so Philip answered him, "Well, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have even a little." Now, a denarius, it's how much you pay a day laborer if he works for you all day. You know, you pick up one of the fellows over at Home Depot and you hire him for the day. What you pay for him, you would pay one denarius for a whole day's wage. I don't know, we might do, if we're generous, we might do $100 or something like that. How much would you earn in a day? Well, this is 200 denarii, so you've got about $20,000. And Philip is saying, look, even if we had 20,000 bucks, which they don't, if we had 20,000 bucks, we couldn't do this. To even give everybody one chicken McNugget, you know, we couldn't afford to do this. That's how big the crowd is. One of his disciples, verse 8, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what's that among so many?" You know, how good is that? The word he uses for lad, it means a little boy, somebody younger than school age. So, you know, 4 years, 4 or 5 years old, something like that. Just a little kid. And he's got barley loaves. That's kind of what a barley loaf would look like. And he's got fish, 2 fish. Now, my basket has 3 fish. Little fish, Galilee has tilapia in it. And so we think that might be somewhat the kind of fish he's got, tilapia. Does anybody like to eat tilapia? I like tilapia. It's good fish. They call it in Israel, they call tilapia St. Peter's fish. And this is how you eat it, like that. And yes, I had permission to show that picture. I asked permission, so I don't owe him $5. That's my son, Timothy. There's a lesson here. I better get him off the screen. There's a lesson here, gang. Availability. It seems to me that one of the keys to this whole story is availability. What God is looking for are people who are willing to give him a chance to use them. Doesn't require college degrees. Doesn't require lots of money. Doesn't require knowing the right people or having a lot of friends. Doesn't require being born in the right family. Those are the kinds of excuses that we all use. Oh, God could never use me. I'm not smart enough, or I'm not rich enough, or I'm not this enough or that enough. What God is looking for is someone to say, "I got my lunch." Little boy apparently was willing. No, actually, we don't really know that he was willing. I guess, you know, maybe Andrew had him in a chokehold or something. I don't know. that's a new twist to the story. I think the little kid obviously was willing to give up his lunch. Andrew was willing to just see what he could do. Availability, gang. 2 Chronicles 16:9. "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him." God is just looking for someone who will trust him. He's just looking for someone who will trust him, that he can work through, that he can give his strength through and to. Verse 10. Then Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." So there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Now, it's springtime, so there's loads of grass. Lots of places to sit. Mark tells us that they broke the crowd up into groups of 50 and 100, so they didn't just have one giant mass of people. It says here that the men were 10,000. John just gives us the number of the men. But there were more than just men there. Matthew says, now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men besides women and children. Well, that doesn't mean that the women and children had to sit and watch while only the men ate. It means that they only counted the men. So there could have been something like maybe 10,000 people. That's kind of on the small side. I think maybe it was like 15 or 20 or 25 or 100,000 people. I don't know. But there's a lot of people there. A lot of people. Verse 11. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they want. So, having lunch, unleavened bread and fish. What does that sound like? That sounds to me like fish tacos. Well, I mean, it is. Enrico, there you go. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. Therefore, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. There's 12 baskets left. Why are there 12 baskets? Because there's 12 disciples and they're all out working and they all come back with a full basket. They all come back with a full basket. Verse 14. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, this is truly the prophet who is to come into the world. Now, we saw this term, the prophet, last week. This is the term that Moses uses to describe the Messiah. He said in Deuteronomy 18, Moses continued, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him. So the people are starting to kind of get it. They're not going to quite completely get it, but they're starting to get who Jesus is. One last thing I just want to suggest here. One last lesson. Fed by feeding. Fed by feeding. So how do you do when you're under a test? You call in sick? And you say, I'm sorry, teacher, I can't take the test. I'm sick today. Do you bail? Do you call up everybody and say, I'm sorry, I'm under stress, I can't do this? I find it interesting, gang. Remember what Jesus and the disciples are under right now. Jesus has just lost John. The disciples are wasted from their trip around Galilee. Yet Jesus says, fellows, let's do a little bit more. Let's just do a little bit more. And I find it interesting that while they are serving others, they get fed. I'll bet those of you who show up at the food outreach on Saturday once a month, I'll bet you get that, don't you? I'll bet you understand that when you help other people, man, don't you come away just tickled and excited and thrilled how awesome it is to help other people? When you feed people, and I'm not just talking food, but when you help others, you get helped. So what's God been saying to you lately? What's God been saying to you today? If you look at your notes, look at the scripture, what's God been encouraging you with? Is the sound up? We got one last clip. Let's review the story, and you think about what God has been saying to you.
After this, Jesus went across Lake Galilee, or Lake Tiberias, as it is also called. A large crowd followed him because they had seen his miracles of healing the sick. Thank you. Jesus went up a hill and sat down with his disciples. The time for the Passover festival was near. Jesus looked around and saw that a large crowd was coming to him.
Where can we buy enough food to feed all these people?
He said this to test Philip. Actually, he already knew what he would do.
For everyone to have even a little, it would take more than 200 silver coins to buy enough bread.
Another one of his disciples, Andrew, who was Simon Peter's brother, said,
"There is a boy here who has 5 loaves of barley bread and 2 fish. But they will certainly not be enough for all these people."
Make the people sit down.
There was a lot of grass there, so all the people sat down. There were about 5,000 men. Jesus took the bread, gave thanks to God, and distributed to the people who were sitting there. When they were all full, he said to his disciples,
"Gather the pieces left over. Let us not waste a bit."
So they gathered them all and filled 12 baskets with the pieces left over from the 5 barley loaves which the people had eaten. Seeing this miracle that Jesus had performed, the people there said, "Surely this is the prophet who was to come into the world."
When I see that, I can't help but wonder, what am I worried about? When you see what he did, what he can do, and I look at the situation that I'm current, whatever my current situation is, why don't I just trust him? Why don't I just trust him? One of the songs we sang this morning, what's it called? Mountain Maker, Ocean Tamer, Star Creator, Wind Breather. He does that stuff. Do you think he can handle you? I think so. Let's stand. Let's pray.